got a sprain or an itch, pain that's swelling or twitch, call up and ask me, Dr. Lasky. Call up and ask me, Dr. Lasky.
Welcome to another edition of Hey Doc. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center, right here in Jacksonville, Florida. I'm your host for the next half hour. With me today is my co-host and wife, Carmen Lasky, a certified EMT. Together, we hope that you will find the show informative, educational, as well as entertaining.
Just over 2 weeks ago, AstraZeneca announced that their vaccine had an efficacy of 79% based on phase 3 trial data from the United States. Then, less than 24 hours later, a trusted source from the National Institutes of Health, or NIH, said that an independent panel of experts had raised concerns over the data.
This announcement came right after several countries temporarily halted vaccination in response to a number of vaccine recipients developing severe blood clots and rare types of stroke.
Within a week or so of that distracting news, the European Medicines Agency stated that the vaccine does not carry an increased risk of blood clots and that the benefits of having the vaccine outweigh the risks of any of the side effects. In their own statement, AstraZeneca reported an efficacy of 79% at preventing symptomatic COVID-19 and 100% efficacy at preventing hospitalizations and severe illness.
They also stated that the vaccine was well tolerated and the Independent Data Safety Monitoring Board identified no safety concerns related to the vaccine.
One of the problems that the DSMB had with the data was that there was a concern that AstraZeneca may have included outdated information from that trial, at least according to the NIH.
At just about the same time as this information became public, a number of countries halted use of the AstraZeneca vaccine because a small number of people developed blood clots.
Then the European Medicines Agency, again the EMA, announced that the AstraZeneca vaccine does not increase the risk of blood clots. Now, following that statement, France, Italy, Germany, Spain, Portugal, and the Netherlands announced that they would restart the rollout over the coming days.
In fact, what the European Medicines Agency found was that the number of clotting events within people who had been vaccinated was actually lower than would be expected from the population at large.
Since Joe Biden has been president, we have really heard little from former President Trump. However, on March 17th of this year, Trump, during an interview on Fox News, urged people in the United States to get the COVID-19 vaccine. He said, and I'm going to quote this, "I would recommend it, and I would recommend it to a lot of people that don't want to get it." At about that same time, and in an effort to encourage vaccine uptake, a group of clergy at Washington National Cathedral lined up to receive a COVID-19 shot. This was aimed to reach Black and Latino communities, as well as others whose vaccine hesitancy is most prevalent.
More studies are, of course, coming to light. For example, a new study helps alleviate concerns that people may still be vulnerable to asymptomatic COVID-19 after vaccination.
The researchers found that people who have had two doses of an mRNA vaccine are 80% less likely to develop asymptomatic COVID-19 than people who have not received the vaccine. Now, a lot of us, of course, are still quite concerned about how well the present vaccines will do against the new coronavirus variants, such as the UK variant and the African strains.
A new study by researchers at the Mayo Clinic in Dorchester, Minnesota, does offer reassurance that the Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna mRNA vaccines provide a high degree of protection against asymptomatic infection.
Their analysis suggests that the risk of such an infection is 79% lower among those who received a first shot of either vaccine more than 10 days previously compared with people who have not been vaccinated.
And the researchers estimate that protection from asymptomatic infection is slightly better after a second dose of either vaccine and 80% compared with people who had not been vaccinated.
Out of almost 5 million people who have received the vaccine throughout Europe, there have been just 30 reports of blood clots. Now, Dr. Head said, "The data we have suggests that numbers of adverse effects related to blood clots are the same, and listen to this, possibly actually lower in vaccinated groups compared to unvaccinated populations. Deep vein thrombosis, also called DVTs, happen to around one person per 1,000 each year, and probably more in the older population being vaccinated.
Working on the basis of these figures, out of 5 million people getting vaccinated, we would expect significantly more than 5,000 DVTs a year, or at least 100 every week. So it is not at all surprising that there have been dirty reports.
You know, halting a vaccine rollout during a pandemic does have its consequences. This results in delays in protecting people and the potential for increased vaccine hesitancy because people have seen the headlines and understandably, they become concerned. And according to Dr. Head, there are no signs yet of any data that really justifies these decisions.
Let's get back to the Pfizer and Moderna vaccine, which contain messenger RNA or mRNA. There had been some anxiety about allergic reaction can lead to vaccine hesitancy.
However, a recent study which included more than 50,000 people who had received this type of vaccine concluded that allergic reaction rates are extremely low. Now, how about that Novavax vaccine? According to a press release from Novavax, their vaccine candidate has an efficacy of 96.4% against cases of COVID-19 caused by the original strain of SARS-CoV-2 and 86.3% against the UK variant.
Again, according to Dr. Michael Head, Senior Research Fellow in Global Health at the University of Southampton in the UK, the Novavax announcement continues the streaming of excellent news in that this vaccine has already shown positive results ahead of an application to the regulators.
However, in the Novavax trials in South Africa, where this variant is now dominant, the vaccine demonstrated an efficacy of only 48.6%.
The point really is, as we stated on innumerable occasions, on former radio shows, the concept of risk versus reward comes into play.
So, which is more risky? Getting the vaccine and running the risk of side effects, or not getting the vaccine and running the risk of getting the virus and the small mortality related to it?
Remember that not all statistics have common sense results.
Let me give you an example. Kind of silly, maybe. Russian roulette is a lethal game of chance in which a player places a single round, generally in a six-shot revolver, spins the cylinder, places the muzzle against their head, and pulls the trigger in hopes that the loaded chamber does not align with the primer percussion mechanism and the barrel causing the weapon to discharge. Now, let me remind you, this is not a game. After a single spin, the probability of it firing is 1/6, followed by 1/5 on the second pull, 1/4 on the third pull, and so on, until it fails to fire 5 times. So the mathematical question remains, is there any advantage of going first or last? Think about it for a moment. Now, most people would think that as the game progresses, your chances of dying increases. Now, this is because, as we have said, at least in the first round, there is 1 in 6 chances of the bullet being lined up with the barrel. Then comes the second player. In the second round, the chance rises to 1 in 5. However, he does not have to play if the first player gets killed. So you have to take into account the chance that you won't have to play because someone has already shot themselves in the face. If you multiply the chance of a bullet being in the chamber with the chance of having to play, you can actually calculate the risk of dying in each round. Now, I'm not going to go into details here, but in the second, there's a 1 in 5 chance of dying times a 5/6 chance of having to play, given that the second person has a 1 in 6 chance of living. And finally, in the fifth round, there is a 1 in 2 chance of dying, but a 2 in 6 chance of having to play. Again, a 1 in 6 chance of dying. So the answer is no. The turn you take in a game of Russian roulette does not make any difference. Again, sometimes the answers to questions like these on the surface seem counterintuitive.
Now, because of the reticence of a good portion of the U.S. populations to get the vaccine, the possibility of obtaining herd immunity decreases.
So what is herd immunity? And why is herd immunity so important?
First of all, the word herd in the case of vaccines refers to our community or population. In this general case, the U.S. population is the herd.
Herd immunity occurs when a large portion of a community becomes immune to a disease, making the spread of disease from person to person unlikely.
As a result, the whole community becomes protected, not just those who are immune.
So first you have to consider the percentage of a population that is actually capable of getting a disease in order for it to spread. And this is called the threshold proportion. Now, if this proportion of the population that is immune to the disease is greater than the thresholds, the spread of the disease will decline.
The more contagious a disease is, the greater the proportion of the population that needs to be immune to the disease to stop its spread.
For example, the measles is a highly contagious disease. It's estimated that 94% of the population must be immune to interrupt the chain of transmission. There are two paths to herd immunity for COVID-19, vaccines and infection.
Vaccines create immunity without causing illness or resulting complications. Herd immunity makes possible to protect the population from a disease, including those who can't be vaccinated, such as newborns or those who have compromised immune system.
Now let's look at the past pandemics and epidemics. Using the concept of herd immunity, vaccines have successfully controlled deadly contagious diseases such as smallpox, polio, diphtheria, rubella, and many others. Now there are some caveats. Protection from some vaccines can wane over time, requiring revaccination. Sometimes people don't get all the shots that they need to be completely protected from a disease.
In addition, some people may object to vaccines because of religious objections, fears about the possible risks, or skepticism about the benefits.
Now, this is the problem that we have today. That is a fairly large number of people who have decided not to get the vaccination. If the proportion of vaccinated people in a community falls below the herd immunity threshold, exposure to a contagious disease could result in the disease quickly spreading.
Measles has recently researched in several parts of the world with relatively low vaccination rates, including the United States. Opposition to vaccines can pose a real challenge to herd immunity.
Well, how about natural infection? That's immunity reached when a sufficient number of people in the population have recovered from a disease and have developed antibodies against future infection. Let's take the 1918 flu pandemic and the people that were later immune to infection with the H1N1 flu, a subtype of influenza A.
The virus that caused the 1918 pandemic infected roughly 500 million people, one-third of the world's population, and caused 50 million deaths worldwide, double the number of deaths in World War I.
In the United States, a quarter of the population caught the virus. That's 675,000 who died. Life expectancy literally dropped 12 years in that short period. With no vaccine to protect against the virus, people were urged to isolate, quarantine, practice good personal hygiene, and limit social interaction. It's all they had.
However, there are some major problems with relying on community infection to create herd immunity to the virus that causes COVID-19.
Well, first, it isn't yet clear if the infection with the COVID-19 virus makes a person immune to future infection. Research suggests that after infection with some coronaviruses, reinfection with the same virus, though usually mild and only happening in a fraction of the people, is possible after a period of months or years.
So, even if infection with the COVID-19 virus creates long-lasting immunity, a large number of people would have to become infected to reach the herd immunity threshold.
Experts generally agree, and they estimate that in the United States, 70% of the population, that's more than 200 million people, would have to recover from COVID-19 to halt the epidemic. So, relying on natural immunity and not supplementing this with vaccine-related immunity puts many people at risk.
This is a great time to tell you about Southside Medical Center. Hello, I'm Dr. Harold Lasky. I have been the medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center for the past 34 years. We're located at 3604 Southside Boulevard, just two blocks south of the Beach Boulevard intersection between the Tulsa Welding School and the old Pottsburg Post Office.
We will treat your pains, sprains, and strains.
We are proud to welcome to Southside Medical Center Dr. Susan Pollan, MD, a board-certified pain specialist.
Our practice emphasizes chronic pain management as well as anti-aging medicine. We also have an office-based substance treatment program for those who need it. Southside Medical Center is open 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. If you would like to make an appointment or ask any questions about Southside Medical Center, please call us at 641-4411. That's 641-4411. 4411. Southside Medical Center, where your health is our primary care.
Welcome back to the Hey Doc Show.
We would like to take the time to answer one of our patients' questions concerning the thyroid gland. Now, I know that it has not really been that long since we talked about this organ that resides in the front of the neck, but there are some unique characteristics concerning the diseases that can occur when its functions go awry.
One of the causes of decreased functioning of the thyroid gland is due to cancer treatment of areas in and around the neck such that the thyroid gland gets affected.
Hypothyroidism is the condition that occurs when the thyroid gland secretes less thyroid hormone than normal. The thyroid gland secretes hormones that regulate the body's metabolism, and it affects a large variety of critical life functions. And these include temperature regulation, heart rate, digestion, as well as muscle and brain functions. So thyroid hormones are simply necessary for life.
So while external beam radiation therapy kills cancer cells, it can also damage the body's normal tissues, one of which is the thyroid gland.
Many patients who have had radiation therapy for the head and neck cancers receive radiation to the area of the thyroid gland, an important organ located in the middle of the lower neck.
Up to 50% of patients treated for head and neck cancer with radiation therapy develop hypothyroidism.
The symptoms of hypothyroidism can include fatigue, weight gain, constipation, sensitivity to cold, dry hair and skin, as well as hair loss, decreased memory, and depression. Now, while hypothyroidism can develop as quickly as 3 months following completion of radiation therapy, it sometimes can actually take years to manifest. And it's important to understand that the thyroid hormones act on nearly every cell in your body.
They are essential to proper development and differentiation of all cells of the human body. These hormones also regulate protein, fat, and carbohydrate metabolism, and they affect how human cells use energetic compounds.
They even stimulate vitamin metabolism. There are two thyroid hormones called T3 and T4. Now, there's also a third hormone that's made in the pituitary gland in the brain that stimulates the production of the two thyroid hormones when those levels go down.
Levothyroxine is the pharmaceutical name of the manufactured version of T4, which is metabolized more slowly than T3 and hence usually only needs once daily administration.
There are also synthetic combinations of T3, T4 in different ratios, as well as pure T3 medications. Levothyroxine, again called T4, is usually the first course of treatment tried. Some patients feel they do better on desiccated thyroid hormones. However, so far, this is really just anecdotal, and clinical trials have not shown any benefit over the biosynthetic forms. Now, most people are treated with levothyroxine or a similar synthetic thyroid hormone.
But some different compounds have different solubilities and potencies.
Since levothyroxine only contains T4, it's largely ineffective for patients unable to convert the T4 to T3.
These patients may choose to take natural thyroid hormone as it contains a mixture of T4 and T3, or they can take an additional supplement of synthetic T3 treatment.
Some studies show that the mixed therapy is beneficial to all patients, but the addition of liothyronine contains additional side effects, and the medication should be evaluated on an individual basis. Thyroid hormones are generally well tolerated. However, thyroid hormones can aggravate heart conditions, especially in older patients. So doctors may start these patients on a lower dose and work up to a larger one to avoid any risks of heart attack.
One question may be, what do we do with patients who apparently no longer respond to additional thyroid hormones of any kind? What do you do then?
For about 1 in 7 of the 10 to 12 million Americans who have an underactive thyroid gland, conventional treatment with the synthetic thyroid hormone levothyroxine just isn't enough.
First, start looking at how you are taking the medication. The best time to take levothyroxine for optimal absorption is 30 to 60 minutes before breakfast or 3 or more hours after dinner.
Taking thyroxine with or too soon before or after a meal or snack could reduce absorption to 64% from a high of 80% when you're fasting, according to the American Thyroid Association. And remember this, coffee consumption has also found to interfere with the hormone's absorption. And here's something else you may want to know, and That is, don't take antacids or supplements containing calcium or iron within 4 hours of the levothyroxine.
Also, don't switch back and forth between brand name and generic levothyroxine. Switching from a brand name to generic thyroid hormone or vice versa could affect your TSH levels, even if the dose is the same.
This is the reason that the U.S. Food and Drug Administration requires that all levothyroxine preparations deliver 95 to 105% of the potency stated on the label. But even tiny variations could make a difference. Now, your physician could consider adding T3, but it might not help. For most people with hypothyroidism, the body converts levothyroxine into T3. But there is evidence this doesn't always happen.
There are many thyroid medications like Synthroid, levothyroxine, Cytomel Armor, and your doctor may make changes to the dosing and you still struggle with thyroid symptoms?
One reason for this failure may be a vitamin deficiency. For example, did you know that many, if not most, patients with thyroid disease find themselves with many vitamin deficiencies?
Some of the most deficiencies seen in thyroid disease include vitamin A, D, K, zinc, selenium, iron, and your B-complex vitamins, including B2, B3, B6, folate, and B12.
Now, we mentioned selenium, and this is important, since selenium and zinc help convert T4 into T3. And iron, zinc, vitamin D, and some of your B vitamins, they help in making thyroid hormones as well. And vitamin A is also needed for improving cellular sensitivity. Many people taking thyroid medications suffer with chemical sensitivities, food allergies, and food intolerances. For those who do have these sensitivities, the most common ones are gluten, dairy, and corn. You may also be sensitive to binders, fillers, heavy metals, and these are commonly found in thyroid medication.
Yes, that's right. These allergens are often found in thyroid medications, and gluten sensitivity and celiac disease often goes hand in hand with thyroid disease and Hashimoto's thyroiditis.
We mentioned Cytomel, one of the T3 thyroid preparations. It uses a starch which is used to bind the medications together. And guess what they're made of? The starches are made from wheat, gluten, and corn.
Now we mentioned levothyrox as a T4 thyroid replacement, but it also contains gluten, dairy, corn, sugar, and all kinds of dyes.
How about aluminum? Is that in thyroid medicines? And the answer could be yes. Now, you might be thinking, aluminum in my thyroid medicine? Well, there are also artificial colors in many thyroid medications, such as red number 40, blue number 1, and yellow number 10. Now, we've talked about your gut and digestion and how it can affect thyroid function.
If, for whatever reason, you cannot break down your foods because you have poor gallbladder function or poor pancreatic function, or even if you don't have sufficient amounts of hydrochloric acid in your stomach, then you may not be optimally extracting your nutrients from the food you eat.
Some nutritional deficiencies can lead to poor T4 and T3 conversion, poor thyroid hormone production, and poor thyroid cellular function. Now, how about stress levels? How about your stress levels? Can this affect your thyroid hormone efficacy? Chronic stress is no stranger to those who suffer with thyroid disease, but it's the stress hormones like cortisol and DHEA that have tremendous impact on thyroid function. Too much cortisol, too little cortisol, or too little DHA pose huge problems for proper thyroid function. Now, if you have weakened adrenal glands due to chronic stress, fluctuating blood sugar levels, or inflammation, you'll need to support your adrenals.
Remember, your adrenals are your fight-flight glands, and any amount of stress on them can have far-reaching effects on your whole body, including digestion.
Your liver has over 300, sometimes I've even heard up to 540 separate functions, one of which is filtering blood from the digestive system. It's also involved in cholesterol production, producing bile that helps eliminate toxins from the body. It processes hormones, and it helps in making many enzymes. The liver is also the place where 60% of the T4 thyroid hormones are converted into active T3. Now, some medications like aspirin, Tylenol antidepressants, antibiotics, birth control pills, synthetic estrogens can overwork your liver.
You may not have heard of it, but there is something else that the thyroid gland makes, and it is called reverse T3.
High levels of something called reverse T3 can cause low thyroid opioid symptoms. Under periods of chronic stress, such as low-calorie diets, malnutrition, excessive cortisol production, even severe illness, inflammation, your body will take T4 and convert it into reverse T3.
The problem is that reverse T3 is not the same as T3, and high levels of reverse T3 bind to the thyroid receptors that are meant for T3. The end result is low thyroid hormone levels. This can happen despite having normal T3 thyroid levels on blood work.
Oh, well, there's just no way that we can complete this topic in one radio show. And it is interesting enough to merit another show. So next week, we may finish this topic so you can be up to date on the newest research in thyroid treatments.
I'd like you, our listeners, to know that I am one of several physicians right here in the Jacksonville area that has received the certification to recommend medical marijuana to those patients with certain qualifying diagnoses. For more information, you can call our office at 641-4411. We have also set up a special website at CompassionateCareJax.com, where you can get a whole lot more information on medical marijuana.
We've come to the end of another Hey Doc show.
So, from all of us here at Southside Medical Center, have a happy and healthy weekend. Goodbye.